Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. I am beyond excited for today's episode because when I started the Preacher Boys podcast in 2020, I started thinking about experts and commentators and authors that I wanted to be able to talk to at some point through the course of the show. And near the top of the list, if not at the top of the list, was today's guest, Dr. Stephen Hassan. Dr. Hassan is a leading cult expert who wrote the incredible book, Combating Cult Mind Control. He wrote Freedom of Mind, and he wrote the recent book, The Cult of Trump. And he's the one who developed the popular BITE model to determine whether a group is using authoritarian control. And he is just a brilliant expert in the world of cults and high control groups. And so he's the perfect guest for this podcast. So on today's show, we talk a little bit about his background. We talk a little bit about some of his biggest influences. We talk about how things have changed since the mid-80s when he wrote Combating Cult Mind Control to today with the advent of the internet and all the different ways that cults have really change and the way we consume information itself has changed. And so I enjoyed this conversation. I really hope you enjoy it as well. I think it's packed with a lot of great information, a ton of fantastic book recommendations, which I will link in the show notes of this episode, and so much more. Thank you so much for tuning in. And please, please, please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Stephen Hassan. Dr. Hassan, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I read your book, Combating Cult Mind Control, back in 2020, around the time I started this show. And it's one of those books where you're reading it and you're like, is this book about me? You start going through the process of it. And I'm curious, when you wrote that book, it was 1988. The internet was kind of in its infancy. And there was a lack of access to a lot of information about cults. Now, reading, you know, The Cult of Trump, you end the book talking about the internet and how technology is affecting how we view cults. In an age where we have so much information about cults, an excess, podcasts, books, et cetera, why do you think cults are still such a big problem in 2024?
Ah, great question. So let me start by saying when I wrote Combating, it was the 10th anniversary of Jonestown. It was 12 years after my exit, I believe, from the Moonies cult, which is what got me interested in the whole subject of brainwashing and mind control. And it was definitely before the internet. My recollection is the internet started like 1994 or 5 is when I first heard about it. And it changed everything dramatically to the point where I was trying to get the rights back to Combating to update it because my whole approach had to change once the internet came around. I eventually bought the rights back in 2014 and did an updated edition with just one T in the Combating. So my perspective is that, you know, human beings have always influenced each other. We're storytelling creatures. There's always been alpha males and females that, you know, want the choicest food or the hot babes or whatever the right associate. That's probably not politically correct to say that, but the choicest mate to copulate with. And then I read the history of God, you know, Karen Armstrong's tome. She was a runaway nun from a convent. I don't know if you know Karen Armstrong's work, but I frequently recommend it to people leaving cults of all types of religious cults. But what I'm trying to get at is that people have influenced each other, but it's gotten more and more sophisticated in terms of understanding what are the mechanisms and what are the techniques. And I started the cult of Trump. I decided, you know, to go back to Edward Bernays and his 1928 book, Propaganda. But there was certainly propaganda before. In fact, the term propaganda is from propagate, from the Catholic Church, going out and proselytizing and bringing people into their fold. And how I see it with the internet and social media and AI is that we're living in an age of psychological warfare, frankly. That it's gone from just selling people the need for body deodorant or, you know, having a certain type of car or having a certain type of body. It's gone from just that level of marketing and making money to radicalizing people to become soldiers for political purposes, state actors, etc. And that religion has been co-opted in the United States largely by bad actors. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm against religion or organized religion, because I'm not. I'm Jewish. I belong to a temple for 26 years, very progressive temple, I might add, where questioning is highly valued and not obedience or dependency. But what I'm trying to get at is that human beings were not created for digital environments. Like, this is the wild, wild west, and there are very powerful corporations that are mining our data. There's no privacy data legislation. There's no real regulation of social media platforms. So there's all kinds of recruitment into Nazi groups and Islamophobic groups and misogynistic groups and hypnosis groups that are going to teach you how to rape somebody or going to teach you how to believe you're an alien in a human body, etc. So to answer your question, why is it more now? I'd also answer that the historical indicators are always that when society or the structures that give us stability are in great flux or uncertainty, people grasp even more for some kind of hope and certainty. And of course, we want to live and we want to eat and we want to have a future. And if I may, Eric, just cite my mentor, Robert J. Lifton's work, Robert J. Lifton's 1961 book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, was used in my deprogramming from the Moonies in 1976. But I went on to read all of his books, and I've done a bunch of interviews with him. He's still very sharp. He's in his mid-90s now. I really appreciated his concept called symbolic immortality. He was rebelling against Freud and Jung and saying, you know, I don't think it's just about sex or fear of death. But he talked about how people want to believe that there's more. More than just this one reality, and that people like to believe they're making artwork that will live on beyond their lifetime, or having children, or doing other acts that will, you know, be a legacy. And he said, once the nuclear bomb entered our imagination and we could no longer feel safe, that You know, yeah, there may be a war and there might be localized devastation, but we couldn't imagine total annihilation of everything that lives. Everything in his model got erased as symbolic immortality, except for transcendence, what he called transcendence, but the belief in the afterlife or belief in outer space and living on Mars or other versions like that.
Yeah.
And right now, people are facing global climate disaster, so many disruptions, including AI and such. So people are grasping for meaning, hope, community, purpose. We all go through life cycle events of vulnerability. I was recruited when my girlfriend dumped me and three women flirted with me. Some people get recruited when they have a death of a loved one or some major illness, or they are refugees, they're going to a new city, state, or country or something, and they trust the wrong person, or and what I keep saying is people don't knowingly say, yeah, abuse me, exploit me. And then, of course, they're the people who are born into these abusive authoritarian cult groups. Tens of millions of people have been raised in these environments.
One of the things I've really been grappling with a lot lately is, I don't know if you've read Brian Kloss's book, Corruptible, but he basically puts out the premise that bad people are disproportionately drawn to power, disproportionately good at getting power, and disproportionately good at keeping power. And one of the things he brings up in his book is that good people don't usually find their ways into position of power because they don't desire power. So I'm curious, in these environments, religious groups, self-help groups, how do we stop the flow of bad people rising to power quickly and make it a place where good people not only want to be in a position of power so they have access to help people, but also they can maintain that power, and there's not this constant loss of power to kind of these negative forces?
Wow. So deep questions you're asking me. Of course, I'm a mental health professional, so I've had to look at developmental psychology and attachment theory and really look at personality disorders. And the latest theories that make a lot of sense to me is that people who have insecure or disorganized attachment with their central mother, father, caregiver don't have a healthy sense of self. And so they become narcissistic, they become borderline, they become seeking for a need to feel loved and have that access of mirror neurons with their mother or their father or their grandparents, where there's a contagion effect through mirror neurons. And if you're with someone who loves you and is talking to you lovingly and telling you stories, you feel valued and you hopefully will feel safe and protected from predators, and you're fed when you're hungry and you sleep when you're tired and you have security. And all of these personality disorders seem to be a compensation from a lack of that feeling secure. And so when I teach, I want people to understand. And that's why I call my podcast The Influence Continuum, because I want people to understand healthy influence from unhealthy. Healthy parenting, if I may, the parents understand that their job is as a steward to this unique child, and to help that child grow up to be their self, to be their true self. And it's called authoritative parenting, that's developmentally appropriate, aimed at empowering the child to have play and explore. And unlike unhealthy parenting, which is authoritarian and often has corporal punishment and an emphasis on obeying the rules versus learning how to navigate life, learning how to make mistakes and not take it personally, but this is part of how we learn and grow. And so for me, when I look at cult leaders, they have what Eric Fromm described as malignant narcissistic tendencies. Is that a phrase you've heard before?
Yes.
Yeah. So I did the chapter 3 of The Cult of Trump, comparing him with Jim Jones and Moon and Hubbard. And for your listeners, I'll just read off quickly. The regular narcissism, which is considered to be on a spectrum, grandiose self-centered behavior, fantasies of power, success, and attractiveness, need for praise and admiration, sense of entitlement, and the key is lack of empathy, the inability to feel for another human being. Put yourself in their shoes and imagine if they've been traumatized, what that's like, because they lack that. They can compensate and guess what behaviors are good or bad, but it's not a feeling state, which healthy people feel. And nobody wants to be hurt, and they don't want to hurt anybody. So they have that natural regulation effect. But here's where the psychopathological piece comes into malignant narcissism. They think they're above the law, so they don't think twice about antisocial behavior. They are typically liars or pathological liars. They're interpersonally exploitative, so they enter into relationships only thinking what they can get out of it. They're often sadistic, harassing and silencing, violent, paranoid, and have an inability to trust. So why is it that a capitalist society is rewarding people who have these malignant narcissistic tendencies? Well, they're typically very charismatic in the sense of they can be charming, they can be very seducing, they can make you feel like you're the center of the universe, but it's a technique. It's not genuine feeling. And they're often just working really hard to prove how great they are to everyone else. So they may be workaholics and achieve some great things. But when it comes to like having a community and treating people respectfully with equal rights, people are objects to them,
right,
to serve their purpose. And it's typically with cult leaders, power, money, and exploitative sex. And so why do we have so many leaders who aren't Zen monks and,
sure,
and priests who actually are humble and put God ahead of humans? Well, it's the nature of the way our societies have been constructed so far.
Right. Well, you mentioned capitalism, and this is not to say that capitalism is the only driver, because like you said, there's plenty of non-wealthy, you know, cult leaders who get sex or they have access to other forms of power. But this is actually something I was talking about recently with somebody, is that the reason I think we're seeing the Donald Trumps, the Andrew Tate, which I'm not sure if you've gone down that wormhole too much. But
actually, yeah, I do a lot of work with trafficking, sex and labor trafficking. Well, so
he'll come up quickly in that conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
But Donald Trump, Andrew Tate, the guys that really have a stronghold on culture represent, I think, on paper, the ideals that are promised to people who pursue the American dream. So you have a Donald Trump who exudes this idea of extravagant wealth. There's some debate about how much wealth there actually is. You have the Andrew Tates who have the Bugattis and the women that he sleeps with. And this picture that I think for the sixth grade middle schooler who's watching reels on, you know, YouTube or watching TikTok videos, they see a achievable thing that they're being told to pursue in the education system, in the culture. And so those people are kind of a beacon of, you know, we could accomplish this. And I think that's really the entire middle class looking to Trump as the idealization of, this is what we could work to. If we just keep working, we can hit this. And that's a really hard thing to combat.
I've interviewed people, including Craig Unger and Yuri Shvets, who wrote American Kompromat. And Yuri was a KGB official. And his words, he was much higher up in the KGB, as in Vladimir. And he said that Russia had recruited Trump as an asset decades ago. It's not in the media as much as it should be, although his support for Putin over his own intelligence agencies when he was president is obvious. But if you start thinking about, you know, the mind control wars America had with Russia, with MK Ultra and everything else, it's just decades later with more sophistication. And the public are sitting ducks and they don't understand how our data, how our minds are being bent and nudged to think that this is a good thing to be like them, to be a pathological liar and to be so insensitive. And I recently saw a documentary that is not in the US yet, but a book is coming out about it, about Andrew Tate. And his program was all around hypnosis and hypnotizing young men into believing that the ideal male is a version of Andrew Tate. And but I too think there was Russian influence there as well on us. And I don't mean to make anybody believe the Russian people are the problem. I'm talking about Putin and the criminals that have taken over this former Soviet Union.
I'm going to get you back into today's episode in just a moment, but first I want to thank the sponsor that is making today's episode possible, and that sponsor is Factor. Factor creates no prep, no mess meals. You can meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, no matter how many podcasts you're recording, going up and down the stairs, trying to take meetings, whatever you're doing, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. And I can say this from experience. They were kind enough to send me a couple of meals for this week, and I enjoyed one just shortly before reading this ad. And it is amazing. And with 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. You can make your day delicious from breakfast to dessert and stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. And these aren't meals that skimp on quality either. You've got things like filet mignon, shrimp, blackened salmon, and so much more. So if you want to try it, go head over to factormeals.com/preacherboys50 and use code preacherboys50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code preacherboys50 at factormeals.com/preacherboys50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Go check out Factor, and now check out the rest of this episode.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
There's 10,000 paths to take from here, but I think on the practical side, you're looking at this as a mental health professional, as a former cult member, as someone who is concerned, to say the least, about many of these trends. When it comes to these conversations, inevitably the conversation topic of what do we do now comes up. I question this all the time. Is the most beneficial use of time for people like myself, for people who are trying to sound the alarm about this, is it addressing the numerous lies and inconsistencies that are spread from these leaders? Because it doesn't seem like that's super effective because of how much brainwashing there is. Or is it most effective to start working on changing the value systems within the culture, both in the culture at large in the country, but also our smaller cultures, churches, synagogues, temples, like schools? Is that a better use of time in saying, here is a better method for, again, the middle schooler who's watching feminists get owned on YouTube and then going down this pipeline. Where should the attention be focused in terms of education?
Great questions, Eric. So what I want to say is that I believe former members of authoritarian cults, and I don't mean just religious cults, but could be political cults, therapy cults, a controlling partner, a multi-level marketing group, a large group awareness training, trafficking, and other applications. I think the first step is just healing yourself and understanding and reclaiming your power and having real clarity and having a trust and a friendship with yourself that, you know, life is precious and it's a gift. And to be in your body and to sleep 7 to 9 hours a night and to exercise and to eat healthily and to have real life friendships and relationships and not just an online persona and life is where I would start. And as you probably have encountered, the general public walk around thinking only weak, stupid people could ever be in a cult or allow these types of abuses to take place. And it's nothing could be further from the truth. So not only, you know, having this knowledge for yourself, but being able to explain social psychology to other people, being able to explain, again, the difference between ethical and unethical influence. My BITE model helps a lot, control of behavior, information, thoughts, and emotions. And to answer your question, I think that being online, especially in this moment in 2024, is really dangerous for our brains. And we have to remember smartphones are tools for us. We should not be controlled by apps or platforms. We should be making our agenda for what we want to accomplish and using social media and using the internet to accomplish our agenda and not just looking for how we can influence other people or become an influencer or how I can make money by monetizing my YouTube. So that's another piece. And I really think that former members would do well to network more with each other. It's enormously beneficial when somebody's coming out of Scientology or mentioning combating. Well, everybody knew the Moonies were a cult, you know, those mass weddings and that fat Korean billionaire who said he was sinless. It's like, I can read that book. And then you read it and it's like, you're describing my group.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I didn't know most of the groups that former members tell me about, but I really just tried to look at patterns, like what are the consistent patterns I keep hearing from people, and using my own experience as the baseline. And fortunately, the book is still helping people.
Sure.
And I'm so happy about that. I went on to develop, after the internet was created, a strategic interactive approach for how to talk to people in cults. Why? Because the original method I was describing in 1988, when smartphones happened with, you know, location devices and texts, it was impossible to have access to a cult member for more than an hour or two unless you could take their phone away, and nobody was giving up their phone.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I had to evolve the approach. And what I realized anyway is really family and friends and people who care are the ideal agents to interact with a cult member, to ask them questions in a respectful, curious way, to empower them, not to tell them they're in a cult or to persuade them with facts, but just to engage in a relational thing, being nice to them. And I arrived at that because I knew as a Moonie, when people called me names or threw things at me, it made me a stronger member. It made me feel more persecuted. And when people were kind and nice to me, Like when I was a Mooney, it was like summertime. It was 90 degrees. I was sweating. And somebody said, "You look really hot. Can I buy you a soft drink?" You know? I was like, "Oh, well, God is sending me someone something to drink." Yeah. Okay. And then I was drinking, I don't know if it was a Coke or something. And then he said, "I'm curious, when was the last time you talked with your mom or your dad?" Mm. And I was like, "It's been a while." And he said, let me walk you to the phone. I'll pay for." And back then you put I think it was a dime or a quarter in the payphone, the rotary payphone. I will never forget this person, this stranger, got me on the phone with my mom. This was like a 5-minute mini intervention, but I never forgot the kindness.
Yeah.
And just to reconnect me that I have a mom, you know, that the world wasn't being in the Moonies and sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night and Moon and his wife being my true parents, right? It's these acts of kindness. I talked to a guy who was a neo-Nazi, anti-Semite, and when I asked him, "Well, what was it that helped you, you know, realize that it wasn't for you?" He said, "It was really hard to hate all the time. And I had this job, and I had a Jewish boss, and he saw that I didn't have lunch, and he walked over to me, he broke his sandwich in half and offered it to me." Or when I went to the McDonald's and there was a black employee smiling at me and friendly and wanting to take my order. For him, it was like, I like them better than the people in my group, right? And then ultimately he had a daughter, and it was like, do I want my daughter to experience hate, or do I want her to feel love and be part of a community? Mm. So what I'm trying to convey, I really think and I really believe that people have an inner nature, a spirit or whatever you want to call it, a divine essence that wants love and wants truth and wants friendship and doesn't want to be abused and exploited and to walk around in fear and hatred all the time. Mm-hmm. And so there are real opportunities, to get back to your question, to transform your church or your temple, your mosque or your local library or whatever, just by being a good citizen and just being present and opening the door for someone if they're holding packages and smiling at them, because it's contagious. You know, you smile, they want to smile, as opposed to grimace. And we need more kindness, we need more care, we need more practical real-life relations and not so much of this intensity online, I think.
Yeah, the debate or especially the name-calling, like the word cult, just shuts down conversation, you know, so quickly. And I know for myself growing up, you know, we literally had the doctrine of separation. It's like you separate from people that are not like you. And we were taught the Bible verses that, you know, they hate you because they hated me, coming from Jesus. And, right. And so it was a confirmation bias to say, if I'm being persecuted, that proves further that we're right and they're wrong. And I've heard from many people I've talked to on the show where coming out of that high control religious group was, well, this gay man next door was very kind to me. And we were taught they were an abomination. They're going to hell, but the jerk that I sit next to in the pew is not. You know, like it was kind of this eye-opening experience. And I'm curious, just digging a little bit deeper into this topic, how do you go about addressing the issues? So once you have the conversation, once you're sitting down having a discussion, how do you address the very harmful topics like, hey, you haven't slept in a while. Hey, you're being worked to death. Hey, you're being taught this thing that's really hateful. How do you do that without making them hunker down into that position of, well, the more you push back, the further into my ideology I go? And I see this happen in political discourse all the time.
Yeah, you're asking me really good questions. I guess I want to start by just saying I have, with my influence continuum, my perspective is that cults exist along the entire continuum. So when people immediately jump to a pejorative interpretation of cult. I try to say, I'm in the cult of TEDx. I've done 4 talks, or I'm a scuba diver and I'm in the cult of scuba diving, or I'm in a book, literally the cult of Mac.
Yeah.
Because I've only had Apple computers and devices for my computer thing. So I tried to reframe cult to, you know, healthy, benign, productive cults. Like you can be a rabid, you know, Taylor Swift fan, or, you know, love a particular sports team or whatever, to authoritarian or destructive cults. So I try to talk about both. What I've learned are patterns of what you don't want to do is ever attack the leader, the doctrine, or the policy directly, ever, because it does make the cult identity defensive. And when I say the cult identity, you know, my model is that mind control is a dissociative disorder. So you have a real self and the cult self. And I recently just heard from Natan Sharinsky, who is a Soviet emigre, talking about what's happening in Russia now, where people have doublethink. They have to behave publicly like they like Putin, but privately they're putting up the third finger and going like this. But that's, you know, and there are many people who are born in cults. We call them PMOs, physically in, mentally out, with this division, etc. And so my whole methodology is based on not persuading or attacking the cult identity, but empowering the person's real self through warmth, through curiosity. But one has to take an open-minded, non-judgmental position with anybody who's involved with a group. In other words, and I want to do a shout out to organizational psychologist Adam Grant and his book Think Again, which I think is brilliant. And you just take the posture of, this is what I believe, but I'm open to changing my mind, you know, like convince me, like let's discuss it. And, you know, if you can convince me that Scientology is the greatest religion on earth, let's talk about it. And as opposed to Hubbard was a pathological liar and a bigamist and a homophobe and, you know, a creepy dude, you know, okay, so what, tell me when you first heard of Scientology, what did you think it was? And did you read Dianetics? Did you actually read the book? Because I had trouble understanding it. And you find out people didn't read the book. They just quote the book, etc. But the idea here is to empower people to think for themselves versus telling them how to think or what they should think. And then secondly, to create the case examples that you think will be effective for them for what is an authoritarian cult. So for me and my Mooney deprogramming, when they asked me, would you like to learn about Chinese communist brainwashing? I was all in. Because in the Moonies, they were Satan, we were God, right? So sure, I'll learn about Chinese communist brainwashing. But then we went through Lifton's 8 criteria, and they were asking me, so tell me which one of the 8 the Mooney, you know, the Unification Church doesn't do. I had no answer because they did them all.
Right.
Right? But it started me thinking. That's the key. It started me having dissonance that we're God, they're Satan, we should be different, but we're doing the same Chinese communist brainwashing stuff.
No.
Right? And so the idea is instead of being one down and telling people that they're stuck or they're brainwashed, you be peers and you ask questions and you be prepared to open your mind and be influenced by them and change your opinion.
This is something that comes up in a lot of conversations with people that I talk to leaving the church, where they have non-negotiables that they would say they're really big on objective truth. You know, so like, if we don't have the Bible, where do we get our morality? If we don't have this, how do you explain that? And for some, that's like the one area they won't cross. Like they won't get into conversation that questions what the group, you know, in the BITE model, you talk about like the group's map of reality. Like that is objective truth for them.
Right. Well, they believe it, right?
Yeah. So I guess in all these conversations, speaking from their perspective, like, where does objective truth fit into these conversations? Because I think for some people, they go, oh, you're so open-minded, your brain falls out. We've all heard that old cliche. Like,
sure.
Where does objective truth live in your worldview now? And like, do you think it's even something to be having a conversation about when it comes to spirituality and religious groups specifically?
You asked me very deep questions. Objective truth. Well, I go back to, you know, even laws of physics that were objective truths, like Newton was changed as we grew and evolved and had the deeper and deeper understanding of things. We're meaning-making beings and we're storytelling beings. And I think that when we are assuming something is inviolable as the objective truth, that's a tough one. As you were talking about in terms of my work with people in Bible cults, for example, and they say, well, the Bible's the inerrant word of God. I say to them, well, I'm Jewish, and I know that Jesus was a Jew, and I'm curious what you know of Judaism and what it teaches and what its values and the verses that are using, if you're familiar with the context. So I would often do that, and maybe they would be curious. But I would typically bring with me someone who is like seminary graduate, like level, knowing scriptures, who could look them in the eye and say, praise Jesus, you know, let's pray together.
Yeah.
Because I would never pretend to be a Christian with a client. So I would have somebody like that and say, well, do you know the difference between eisegesis and exegesis? And a lot of cult members would be like, what's that?
Yeah.
And well, you know, when we learn Bible, we have to understand there's a difference between having an idea and then looking in scripture to prove it versus reading things in context and putting Jesus's words above Paul's words, putting Paul's in Jesus's context and not the other way around. And then people are like, oh, this is interesting. So instead of this monolithic, you know, we have to stay in this boundaried place, now all of a sudden people are realizing, wow, there's actually more to this than what I was told. But what is objective truth? Hell, if I know.
I suppose if you were claiming it, we'd probably be having a concerning conversation and we'd start going through the model here.
Well, I can only say that we are living a mystery, really, and that what is reality? Well, when I was just listening to a book about brain and neuroscience, and when they talk about there are more connections in our brains than particles in the universe, I don't know how to make sense of that. My rational mind, it's unfathomable analogy. And all I can be is like humble and grateful and like, this is such a gift. And I get to walk around and meet cool people and listen to incredible music and look at art and play with my dog and, you know, go out with my friends and eat delicious food. And be grateful because so many people don't have water or food or these opportunities. But I definitely feel a strong commitment to help others who are less better off than myself. Right. But it took me a few years to get out of my Mooney, you know, self-sacrifice. And it was selfish to think about going back to college. And, you know, it was evil to think about kissing a girl. You know, because it was, you know, evil spirits were invading my mind. You know, it took me a while to get that programming out of my mind, but I was lucky because I had a life before the Moonies that I go back to as a reference point.
Do you think, and I'm curious because you are still religious in some sense, and I know you've gone into detail about the healthy version of that that you experience now. I put myself in a position now of I have no idea what religious living or spirituality means to me in this current stage. But the way that you perceive religion for yourself, do you find that you get more benefit from the object of your belief? So what you're believing in and the being that you ascribe to, or do you just acknowledge that it's the power of me believing in this, that I'm finding some kind of fulfillment by just picking this system and aligning with it, and that kind of evolutionary advantage of religion to you? Where does it sit for you? Like, where does that kind of rest in terms of your experience with religion?
Another deep question there, Eric. The thing is I think of myself more as spiritually minded than religious because I'm not strictly observant. I believe in the idea of Shabbat as a 25-hour period where you disconnect from world and making money and worrying about politics and just sleeping and eating and studying and having sex if you're lucky enough to have a partner, and restoring your batteries. I love the idea of Shabbat. Do I practice it every Shabbat? I wish, but it's more of an ideal. I do it sometimes, but I'm frequently needing to do work-related things on a Shabbat. I also belong to a progressive community, and the rabbi that I credit for bringing me back to identify as a Jew was a comedian and a scholar, and he would tell jokes on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, and he would be telling jokes from the front, and that's the kind of rabbi I want. And by the way, the word rabbi is teacher. It's not like an elevated post. I mean, people who are wise, you elevate them because you look to them for wisdom. My community cherishes questions, not telling people how to behave. It's not about guilt tripping you if you're not wearing a tallit or you mispronounce or missing a song or whatever. And if I wasn't born Jewish and didn't have Orthodox grandparents on my mother's side, I may not be identifying as a Jew. But what I like about the Judaism I believe in is it's this notion that we have a purpose in our life. It's to make the world better. It's to we'll call it tikkun olam, or repairing the world. We aspire to look at the world as an integrated whole, as we believe the divine is, as opposed to fragments. I definitely do not anthropomorphize the divine as a man or a Zeus-like, you know, figure with a beard, with a judgment. If I had to put a label on my faith, I think the technical term for it is panentheism, which simply described is believing that there's divinity in everything, in all living things and inanimate things. And do I think there's an afterlife? No idea. Jews do not, at least the ones I hang out with, are not wanting to get a goody brownie point, so that we are in a good place in the next life. We're about what we can do now. And when it comes to helping others, we're obliged to help, not because we feel like it, because it's the right thing to do. And, you know, if we see a log in front of a blind person and that, you know, they're going to trip, you're obliged to warn the person or walk them around it. It's that kind of community. And the thing about Judaism is you really need to worship together. It's a community thing. There's a thing called minyans. So you need 10 people together to pray properly. There's so many rituals that I like. I like the studying of Torah. I've been doing it whenever I can on Shabbat for 26 years now. And by no means is it taught as an inerrant document. In fact, I don't know if you've ever read Friedman's book, Who Wrote the Bible, but the Torah is written in four distinct voices. And the stories are cobbled together because it was an oral tradition. So it's anything but the inerrant word of God that you can't challenge. And there are centuries of rabbinic arguments about what is the meaning of this verse. And the Talmudic books include both positions. And again, the idea is to question, not to believe blindly anything. So those are the things that resonate for me: to be a good person, to aspire to feel my life has meaning and purpose. Jews are very big on education because we were persecuted, so we often would have to pack up quickly and leave, but you take your knowledge with you. And lastly, I'll just say the central story of the Jews is liberation from Pharaoh and enslavement. And it's a metaphor that really is apt for former cult members of it's scary to go out into the desert. We have at least, a known familiar, yes, we're tortured and we have to work hard, but at least we know what's happening.
It's the devil you know, not the devil you don't, kind of.
Yeah, and but it's a central, Passover is going to be coming up. And one of the central points of telling the story is you want to remember you were a slave. So you want to identify with all oppressed people, no matter what form of slavery they're in. And for me, this is a teaching about empathy. Like if you can put yourself in the shoes of slaves, then you can empathize for what their reality is like. And so I think there's a real value in that. So for those reasons and cultural reasons, I identify as a Jew. And let me state categorically that I'm against religious extremism in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, etc. And I abhor religious extremists who say, I'm not Jewish because I'm not observant enough and I don't have paces and I don't wear a black hat or whatever. I abhor that. We have a female conservatively ordained rabbi and they don't see her as legitimate, as a real rabbi. And I can't relate to that. And that's who's running Israel right now. And I'm so upset.
Yeah.
Not good.
Well, I know we're nearing the end of our time here, and I appreciate, to stick with the metaphor, I appreciate you helping so many on their exodus from these cults. For those who are listening, I know when I mentioned a few days ago in my group that I'd be interviewing you, and I asked if people had some questions. I tried to incorporate pieces of them throughout to try to answer some of those. I know many are familiar with your work. Many have read Combating Cult Mind Control, at the very least. I think that's kind of a foundational piece people read when exploring this. What is the number one resource that you would feel is underutilized currently that you'd push people to check out if they're loosely familiar with the BITE model already or your initial book? What are some resources you'd recommend to people that maybe they haven't checked out already?
Well, thanks for asking. So I definitely recommend Freedom of Mind, even if you're not interested in helping people get out, because I have material in there that builds on combating and Cult of Trump. I created an online course. I have one a series of recordings from a workshop I did in Utah with John DeLynn, who was sixth-generation Mormon psychologist who was excommunicated for his support of gay folks, etc. And if you were born in another Bible-related cult, I think you would find a lot of patterns of what people leaving Mormonism go through that we addressed. I think that's an interesting thing. I have a weekly podcast and blog, and, you know, it's free. We're starting a Substack. And I plan to do more like webinar-type things to try to let people ask me more dynamic questions and such. And I would just say, like, people don't leave an authoritarian group and just put their experience in the closet, shut the door, and pretend that it hasn't influenced them. It's a good short-term strategy, and many people need to leave and just, like, get a job immediately or, you know, just dive into the outside world, if you will, but you really want to do your homework because you don't want to walk around with all this baggage.
No.
You want to really, you know, restore your full self and your trust in yourself, and be careful because there's a lot of so-called cult experts that have taken a course and they're calling themselves coaches and they don't know, they haven't done their own healing, mm-hmm. much less know how to really hone in. One of the first things I learned, Eric, as a therapist was like every person is different. And while you can learn patterns, you need to pay attention to who's in front of you and what's going on with them and sequence things mm-hmm. in a way that's maximally helpful. So most therapists don't know what the hell they're doing. And they're looking for family of origin stuff. We've done a few blogs like, you know, how frustrated ex-members are that they're teaching the therapist
yep.
about cults.
Hear that and, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm saying to ex-members, tell your therapist if they want to be ethical, they need to take this course. And there's a CE version if they need continuing ed credits as a clinician. But it's, you know, one of the first things I was taught as a therapist is that if I have a client with an addiction problem and I haven't received training to treat them, I have an obligation to say, I can't help you.
Yep.
I need to refer you. Or if you're willing, I'll get supervision for your case from someone who's an addiction expert. But people are taking former cult members as clients and often for years, and they're misdiagnosing them and they're not empowering them. So that's why I created this course for clinicians. But in the end, I say it's your mind and only you should control it. So I tell my clients, you be your own best therapist. You be your own best friend. And be honest with yourself and look at all the nooks and crannies and, but know, put the focus on a future you, how you want to be, and identify what's missing or what's blocking from moving forward.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And lastly, I'll just say, I realized about 10 years ago that I was an activist for 40 years and things were getting worse. And I realized the law itself is 100 years out of date with understanding the mind and neuroscience and social psychology. And I got involved with a forensic think tank at Harvard Medical School. And at 63, a professor heard me speak there and he said, you know, if your model really helps people walk out of cults, like they read Combating and they're like, yep, behavior, information, thought, and emotion. He said, you need to go do your PhD and do a quantitative study because the law looks, you know, wants to see scientific evidence. And I said, I'm 63. I'm too old to do this. And he said, I'm 77. And if, you know, do you want to change the law or not?
Right.
And if you want to change the law, do the doctorate. I'll supervise your research. Hmm. And I had to look myself in the mirror going, do I want to change the law? Yes. Am I too old? I'm afraid that I'm too old. I don't know that I have a good memory. I don't know this and I don't know that, but I just went for it. And Eric, I got smarter. My memory improved, my concentration improved, my vocabulary improved, my writing improved. Hmm. So I want to tell, because I frequently hear from people, I'm 40, I'm too old to go to college. I'm like, you're not too old.
Yeah.
focus on what you want and go for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I love the emphasis on people unpacking what happened. I do understand you need to leave, and sometimes you don't need to jump right back into that. But what I've seen, and we could have a whole nother conversation, is so many people understand something bad happened in a group. They don't understand how the group got them to that point. And so I'm seeing a lot of people ping-ponging back and forth from one cultist group to another, one cultist leader, to deconstruction coaches now and therapists now that are, you know, they're culty in their own right, you know? And so I love that emphasis. I appreciate all the resources that people can check out. And I think ultimately the big takeaway here is nobody has the one cookie cutter solution to all of your ailments. And so anyone promising that should be marked and avoided. But I think these are tools that can generally be very helpful. And I'll link to all of those in the show notes of this episode. Dr. Hassan, thank you so much for this.
Awesome. And I want to invite you on my podcast. I want to watch the Max series first, but you'll come and share your experiences with my audience. So that's cool.
Look forward to that. So
great.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. And for anyone listening, be sure to check the link in the show notes for all those resources. And I will see you on a future episode.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.